Welcome. You are listening to Poverty in Focus, this podcast series produced by the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis brings together experts in their fields to discuss new poverty research and public policy. I'm Lisa Pruitt, a professor of law at UC Davis and a Center for Poverty Research faculty affiliate. Today, it's my pleasure to host visiting scholar Ezra Rosser. Rosser is a professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law. Rosser has written extensively on American Indian law. American Indian poverty at 28% is higher than the rate for any other ethnic group in the nation. And yet, the American Indian situation is largely invisible to most Americans, as well as to most critical race scholars. Today, we will discuss why so little attention is devoted to this phenomenon, what policies might effectively combat American Indian poverty, and how it differs from rural poverty, which is my own area of research. Ezra, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about labels. Some scholars and some media outlets refer to Native Americans, and some refer to American Indians. What's your preference and why?
Yeah, so this is a good question and one I often get pushback on. Certainly the first time people hear you say Indians, a lot of people are told to say Native American. In law, Indian is the, if not preferred term, it's the most used term. And so most cases talk about Indians, not even American Indian, just Indian. And Native American in law is used a lot less frequently. In real life, my own rules are if I'm talking to somebody that has not really thought about Indians, then I might use Native American, just, but it's for their sake, not because it's what's right. And with Indian, I tend to use it if I'm talking about overall Indians, but if I'm talking about a particular group, it's best to identify that particular group. And if you know, the better term would be the group name that they use. So, for example, I do a lot of Navajo work. And when I talk about the Navajo Nation as a government, I use Navajo Nation. But when I talk about the people, I use Diné, because that's what their name for themselves are. So I think there are, in any of this, lots of name choices you can do, but I think the central message is Indian is a perfectly fine term and one that is used by Indians, by non-Indians. Another term that I haven't said yet is natives, and a lot of, you know, native student, natives is also perfectly fine.
Great. So how did you become interested in American Indian law? And it's hard to be interested in American Indian law without being interested in poverty among that people.
Great. So my I had what's a somewhat unusual experience of growing up in part on the Navajo Nation. I am white, and my parents were divorced, but one lived in part of the reservation called Kayenta, which is just south of Monument Valley and very pretty. And he was a teacher there, and he, that was my father, he remarried a Navajo woman, and eventually they moved to another part of the reservation, which is her traditional homeland for her family, which is on the road between Shiprock and Lukachukai, so a very remote part of the reservation. And my mother worked for the Navajo EPA and spent her career doing being an environmental planner for the tribe in various capacities. And so that's really the connection. I will say, though, that I moved away from the reservation in high school, and my time on the reservation varies dramatically depending on what my parents are doing. But that's really how I got interested in it. And then as to Indian law, I went to law school because I failed to become a professional photographer. And then when I got to law school, I met my mentor who did Indian law, Rob Williams at Arizona, and he convinced me that doing this and being an academic in Indian law would be a good path. So that, I think, answers. And I came into it wanting to focus on tribal economic development, largely because I thought that's an area where I knew something about that lots of white people don't.
So as I mentioned earlier, poverty rates among American Indians are higher than among any other race or ethnic group. What are the factors that contribute to that really extremely high poverty rate?
Yeah, I think before going into that quite, I want to say that poverty rates for tribes vary dramatically. And so one of the challenges whenever you talk about Indians is recognizing the extreme degree of tribal differences. So there are more than 500, almost 600 federally recognized tribes, and they're also state recognized but not federally recognized tribes, and they have very different experiences. My own, experiences are drawn from Navajo, and most times when people think about this sort of level of poverty, it's from Navajo or Pine Ridge, the Sioux reservations. That being said, all those figures are true. Nixon famously said that Indians measure at the bottom of all these social metrics, whether it's unemployment, housing conditions, poverty. And he said that in 1970, and that remains true today. And I think the reasons are some of them are unique to Indians and some are just what poverty is. So I think it's hard to separate these things out. I would point to lack of opportunities, lack of jobs, these sort of standard things, but just in a very extreme form. So the reservation, Navajo reservation, has more than 50% unemployment. And when you have that much unemployment, you're going to be poor. The reservation also has, on a per capita basis, it's usually about one third to one fourth of the United States, and consistently so. And that is a level of poverty that it has impacts on education, has impacts on everything you can imagine, on what life there is like.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that one of your early interests in American Indian law was in economic development. Mm-hmm. So what particular ideas do you have about alleviating poverty, particularly job development, mm-hmm. job creation, since unemployment is such a major issue?
Yeah, I think for every sector, if you look at tribes that have successfully done this, they've done a range of things. The Harvard Project on Indian Economic Development, what they say is that tribes need to exercise their de facto sovereignty. So it's more about what they actually do than what the law says they can do. And so to some degree, this is a move away from law as a field and more a move towards, in fact, what happens on the reservations. The same could be said, Phil Fricke, who was at Berkeley before he died, he had a similar point that what we need to do is care about what's happening on the reservation. And so what's happening on the reservation that I know, Navajo, is there are some, Navajos have a lot of resources, and the question is how to use those effectively. Some of those resources are very dirty, like coal or power plants, and others are, or uranium mines. Some of those are not so dirty, and the question becomes how do you sort of weigh these development goals with other goals that you have, such as the environment or social goals. I think there are other challenges the tribe has that we don't think about. So we take for granted, say, a land registration system. You go and check your title. Well, you can't do that if you're on reservation. And so it slows down development of just if you have a business idea to make it formal. It's much more like Hernando de Soto talks about for Peru than what we think of as the baseline in the United States. So I think some of these things are very unique to the reservation, sort of defy easy analogies, but do come down to lack of jobs.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I suspect that many Americans are not aware of just how dire the poverty situation is among many Indian populations, among many tribes. And I certainly hear what you're saying about variations from tribe to tribe. And I've noticed in the Legal Academy that while critical race scholarship is this really vibrant, thriving sub-discipline, that there's very little attention to the American Indian situation among critical race scholars. So sort of thinking about those two different populations of consumers, mm-hmm. or critics, if you will, right? Why is there not a greater awareness of the American Indian situation? Why is that not more part of, if you will, the common consciousness of the United States? And why has the American Indian situation struggled to gain traction, I would say, in the Legal Academy broadly, but also among critical race scholars, where you would think it would have a natural home, if you will?
Yeah, so I think I'll start with the first one on the common perception or indifference. And I would say on that, there's a number of thoughts you can have. One is just that, in general, we like to imagine ourselves as innocent of any wrongdoing. And we like to imagine that what happened to Indians is very historical and not ongoing. And so I, in my own work, have focused a little bit on this innocence question. But I think there's a convenience to thinking of Indians as deceased or disappeared, and thinking about him as having a merely, you know, Hollywood existence. And it becomes a lot less comfortable when we think about we're benefiting from their land, and yet we have not compensated them, even in the ways we promised to compensate them. And so I think part of it is this sort of willful denial. I think another explanation that's a little less, you know, psychologically based or something, is that at least for the East Coast and California, the coasts in general, the Indians they do encounter are not necessarily the poor ones. So they encounter Indians with casinos. Now, even though Indians, even when you take into account the casino wealth, when you overall include all Indians, that still leaves Indians below any other group. It does mean that there are these pockets of extreme wealth associated with Indians. And people wrongly feel that these casinos represent Indians when in fact they represent really fortunate few Indians. So I think that that can have a part of an explanation. I think another sort of challenge with that Indians create is why should we care, essentially? If they are removed in their homelands and removed from our experience, what is the reason that whites or non-Indians should care about them? And I think we have not satisfactorily answered that, and so it's easier to ignore or at least use little teeny notes about them, but not comprehensively. Because of their demographics, they're only 2% of the population. They're never going to be like Latinos are becoming or other groups. And so that's another explanation. I think on the critical race scholarship issue, I guess I don't quite fault critical race scholars as much as I think the question might lead. I think that the critical race scholars have a lot of work to do in our society as a whole. And so the fact that they're not paying attention to Indians when others also don't pay attention to Indians, I don't fault in a big way. I would say even within critical race scholarship, this isn't my observation, this is others, but there may be a difference in sort of end goals that may explain this. So if you think just about civil rights work for minorities generally has been to get minorities up to the level of rights enjoyed by the whites. And on the other hand, when you think about Indians, their goal is not necessarily that incorporation. In fact, it may be to preserve the possibility of tribal difference or preserve these isolation. And because those goals are not the same, the scholarship may not lend itself necessarily to using critical race scholarship and poverty law. That being said, or not poverty law, Indian law. That being said, my mentor, Rob Williams, certainly would call himself a crit, probably a critical race person, and he's also an Indian law. So there are people, they may be more known as Indian scholars than they are critical race people, but they are applying lessons from critical race scholarship to Indian issues.
Great, very helpful. So maybe you could explain a bit about the relationship between the federal government and Indian tribes, particularly in relation to poverty alleviation. I think many people who are even have some passing familiarity with the American Indian situation realize that money flows from the federal government mm-hmm. to the tribes. So can you tell us a little bit more about the parts of that that have to do with poverty alleviation in particular?
Yeah, so Indians are semi-sovereign. And so one of the quotes is that they're domestic dependent nations. And in practice, what this means is that while over time we have done things to lessen their sovereignty, we're now in a moment where at least two of the three branches, the executive and the legislative, believe in this self-determination. And they what that takes the form of is grant making so that tribes can take on activities that have been formerly done by parts of the federal government. So tribes are now doing things that the BAA used to do or doing things that IHS, Indian Health Service, may be doing it, but they're giving now grants for tribes to take over hospitals. And so a lot of this is converting the federal trust obligation into a block grant of forms. And that isn't much different from what we do with states or what we do in all sorts of poverty alleviation. What I think is different is that because they are these sovereign entities, even though they're not often recognized as such, they do have power to change those goals and to think, you know, we got money for this and housing to build houses, but what we think is we need a senior center. Well, maybe that's what their decision should be. So I think one is just this sovereignty thing makes it a little different than other sort of poorer communities. And then another on what I guess our policy is, we are continually trying to figure out ways to step back as far as our federal obligations to these tribes. And so there have been, this was one of the arguments for gaming, was that we were in a moment where even Reagan was saying gaming should take place, and it should take place because we want tribes to essentially not have to rely on federal dollars. Well, if that's what you're doing, then that may create more space for these sort of leveraging the sovereignty for development purposes or for anti-poverty purposes, which are often for the tribes the same.
Okay. I wanted to go back to something that you said earlier that I failed to follow up on initially, and that is you suggested that we have maybe as scholars or thought leaders or maybe politicians, the government has failed to answer the question of why we should care about American Indian poverty. And so I wonder what pitch you would make about why we should care about American Indian poverty. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think this is the question. Anybody who does poverty is concerned about whether it's Indian or general, how to make popular attention focus on these. And I think just like in regular poverty, the rise in inequality may be drawing some of this or creating some momentum behind this conversation. The same could be true of Indians. Indians have some things that we want. And so all along, Indians have had land and we've wanted their land or we've wanted access to their land. And certainly with the energy resources that they have, there is a chance to use that as a way to talk about these things. So whether it's fracking in South Dakota, coal mines in Arizona, wind resources and other reservations, there are lots of studies saying that essentially our interests and Indian interests are coming more into contact. And you see this even from such things as mundane as bar exams now requiring Indian law. Well, that is a sign that we, Indian lawyers at least, are encountering Indians in their daily life in a way that was not done before. And I think that that will move some of the conversation about what Indians' obligation, what are our obligations to Indians and why we should care. I think the other is it's just very extreme. And so the New York Times sent a photojournalist to go take photos of poverty in America and made the mistake of sending him to Pine Ridge or Rosebud. I think it was both, but I think he went Pine Ridge and he also took photos of Rosebud as his first assignment in this supposed to be year-long tour of poverty in America, and he never left. There was more than enough material. He decided he's just going to spend the year taking photos of the reservation. And we are seeing, at some point, the extremity of the situation compared to what's found off-reservation is such that our conscience is shocked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's interesting your comments on, as a matter of strategy, to gain attention to the American Indian situation and particularly their economic needs, to focus on what it is that they have that, quote, we want. And I noticed a similar phenomenon among advocates for rural America. In fact, there was a great piece that I got yesterday by email from the Center for Rural Strategies. And, they've put together a little video clip, and it's all about, garnering metropolitan attention to rural America by playing up what it is that rural America supplies and some of its energy and some of its water and, so forth and so on as a way of making metropolitan America, care about rural people's that is rural peoples besides those you see on Duck Dynasty or, whatever, or Honey Boo Boo. That it's about more than that. So anyway, that just prompts me to ask about sort of differences that you see or that you would highlight between American Indian poverty, much of which is rural, although I think we're aware of this migration phenomenon to cities, and rural poverty, more generally. Are there aspects of those two different but overlapping populations that you would highlight as relevant to policymakers?
Yeah, I think there are some things that are just flow from the sovereign status of tribes that make things different. And in particular, for poverty, if you're focusing on poverty, the delivery of the programs to these. So if you are a poor person in a state, you may get your TANF benefits through the state rather than through the tribe, whereas the tribe may be administering those TANF programs. Or in you know, in urban areas, you almost never think of commodities, right? Of getting deliveries of commodities. But in rural areas, including the reservations, you can have commodity delivery. And in fact, there are whole jokes about commodity, how important that is. So I think those things are both the same and different. I think, or healthcare. So we, when healthcare reform was being considered, they looked at Indians as the population that gets free healthcare. Well, that's true, but it also, if you look at the amount that's being spent per person, it's actually less than the federal government is subsidizing the average American who's not getting free healthcare. So I think there are some misleading aspects about the differences as well. I would see lots of them as very similar. I think one difference that's a stereotype, although a stereotype that has some backing behind it, is the connection to place that may be somewhat different. So as somebody who grew up, you and I have talked about this, or in my writing we've talked about this, I grew up in different rural areas. And some of those rural areas, the people have a really strong connection to place, right? They're from there, they're going to grow up there, and they're going to resist moving. Well, for Indians, that may be even more so, right? Their tradition, like, it's not just that they know this place, which makes it something they're tied to, but also their entire spiritual world is based around this place. Whereas, you know, for most Americans, their spiritual world is based on Adam and Eve or some other foreign country.
I thought you were going to say the mall.
Yeah, the mall. That's a good one. So there may be just an additional tie to place that we have for rural Indians versus rural non-Indians. Mm-hmm. That being said, rural non-Indians often are very place-bound.
Mm-hmm. So I just wonder if you had unlimited funds, how you would consider spending it to alleviate American Indian poverty. What programs do you see missing now, or programs that you would bolster? Would you send more money to the tribes for their discretionary spending? What do you think would be an effective strategy for greater alleviation of American Indian poverty?
Great. So I am going to do a duck to some degree in my answer to this. But I think it's a fair duck. And this is something, just to go back to my original comments about why I got into this. As a non-Indian, I don't believe it's necessarily my place or should be my place to say that. So I think one of the things, you know, why I became an academic versus going to work for a tribe, and this was encouraged by Williams and other mentors, was that I have a privilege to be able to be a white person and say things about this while still living the decision-making up to Indians. And I think that that's very important. Charles Wilkinson wrote this book called Blood Struggle that came out in 2005. And what's great about it is he describes over the last century how tribes have made tremendous progress by pushing on boundaries, and many of those boundaries are not things that I would have thought of. He also ends the book. He ends the book with the last chapter is on economic development, which is sort of the negative side on the whole story to some degree. But his last paragraph is about how there are challenges facing tribes, but these are societies that have survived much longer than we have, and have done so in the face of tremendous adversity, and largely done by non-Indians towards them. He had faith in sort of an uplifting promise about it. I'm a little more pessimistic about it, but I do believe in the idea that they're in charge of their destiny. That being said, I think a good starting point that's not unlimited money, but it is more money, is at the bare minimum, the U.S. government should fulfill its trust obligations. So if we make a promise, we should live up to those promises, especially when we've benefited so much from it. So some concrete examples are housing. And there should be more money towards housing, and some of this is guaranteed by treaty itself. Some of these treaties say housing rights. Others, it's guaranteed implicitly. When we take away a lot of land and we leave them with less land, there's a promise we're going to make it livable there. That's the basis of the reserved water rights doctrine, and it can also be the basis of other sort of social amenities such as housing. So I think it's not saying what I do with all the money, but at the very least, we should make a real commitment on the federal side that we have not.
Great. Well, that's a nice place to conclude. You have certainly been a leader, a thought leader, particularly as a relatively young scholar in the areas of both poverty law and American Indian law. And so we are very grateful to have had you with us today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.